Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Arthi Shahani is a technology reporter for National Public Radio based in Silicon Valley. Her family immigrated to the United States from India in the 1980s. Arthi thrived in her new country and earned a scholarship to an elite private school. But her father was arrested for mistakenly selling watches to a drug cartel, which led to years of entanglement in the legal system. These experiences inspired Arthi to write her memoir, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Arthi talks this hour with WDET News Director Jerome Vaughn. Jerome asked Arthi to talk about how she came to write her book.
Now, if you've heard me, you know, on the radio or through your smart speakers before, I like to call myself Indian IT Lady. So, I'm delivering the news on Google, on Facebook, on big tech, and important news, you know, how does artificial intelligence evolve? How are disinformation campaigns disrupting democracy? But what I decided to do, this is my first book, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, was I stepped back in time and felt I needed to share my family's immigrant story. Okay, in a nutshell, my parents were uprooted as small children when the British left the Indian subcontinent. They were among the millions of people displaced through a process, a war really, called the partition. They migrated around the world, effectively stateless. They met in Morocco, married, had three children. I was the last, an accident. And then they decided to come to Queens to cross the Atlantic. We came on tourist visas. We overstayed our visas. We were undocumented for a few years. It was a hard time. I recall more than once, we lived in a really crappy apartment in an awesome neighborhood. But a crappy apartment, just, you know, everything broken, no heat in the winter, that kind of thing. I recall waking up more than once with a roach crawling up my leg. That kind of situation. Then we got our papers through a process that is called and derided as chain migration. It has always struck me that term is a beautiful term. The way I think about it is, every family member is a link on that chain, and the more links you add, the longer, the stronger the chain is. And last I checked, we want strong families in this country. But that's how perverse the conversation has become around the fact of our existence. We get our green cards. We think we are now on the straight shot to the American dream. Everything's gonna be awesome. Okay, not. Things were going well for quite a while because I was now part of the formal, you know, sector of society. I became a scholarship kid at a very fancy private school in Manhattan. The cost of going to that school was, in today's terms, a Tesla a year. While at that school, I learned amazing vocabulary that I had never, ever heard before, like the term country house. Concept blew my mind. Yes. A country house, for those of you who don't know what it is a house that is your second home. I didn't know that there were people that wealthy. My dad, meanwhile, was building his American dream. My father was a brilliant man. He spoke six languages from his world travels. He's on the low end of globalization, as many migrants are. Very scrappy, very smart. He also multiplied very large numbers in his head. When we first got to the US, Dad shoveled snow for $4 an hour. That's the best he could find. It shocked him. Because you hear from the other migrants that America is this land of opportunity and promise, and there's a kind of filtering that goes on because you don't want to cross the Atlantic and then tell your family, I made a mistake and it's really hard. So just the positive stories go back out, right? Anyway, Dad managed to open his own store, his own small business, on the very same street where he used to shovel. Huge accomplishment. And his store was bigger than some of the people who employed him. It was awesome. Not huge, two stories as opposed to one, that kind of thing. One day we get a call. My father has been arrested. He is at Rikers Island. And New York State is charging him and his little brother, my uncle who helped run the store, with selling watches and calculators to the wrong guys, to members of the Cali drug cartel. The way it sounds on paper, it sounds like what the state is saying is my family's business is really just a narco-trafficking front. It's terrifying. I was a kid who wanted to be a prosecutor. I was having a hard enough time accepting who my parents were in the halls of my elite private school. Dealing with my own imposter syndrome and shame, having my father in Rikers Island was not a point of pride. It was not a point of indignation. Oh, the justice system, it was just shame. Long story short, New York State, the prosecutors say, offer a plea deal. And our defense lawyers, we'd hired private defenders, said, Mr. Shahani and Mr. Shahani, here's the deal. No one in this court really thinks you're a drug front. And meanwhile, my father had been saying, we sell watches and calculators to anyone who will buy them. That's what we do. But Mr. Shahani and Mr. Shahani, take a plea. 8-month sentence. You get it over with. Because if you go to trial, there is a trial penalty. That's not written into the Constitution, by the way. That's just how the law is practiced. Trial penalty means you go to trial, and if you get convicted, instead of 8 months, you get 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. Well, shopkeepers don't have that kind of resource. They can't take that kind of risk. And the justice system is not about innocence and guilt. It is about risk and reward. So what did my dad do? What did my uncle do? They do what everybody in that system does. They plead. Well, the 8-month sentence ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle that destroyed my father's life, ended in the automatic exile of my uncle, and singularly defined my life, hanging over me until I was 30 years old. So that's the story that I write. And I decided that I needed to tell you that story because we are in a moment where our nation of immigrants needs to hear from real immigrants. We all are, by the way, most of us are. But many of us are disconnected from our own family stories, and I'm not. So I'm sharing it with you.
Please, please. So I want to go back to your time in Queens.
Yeah.
When we were having dinner, one of the things I said was, when I read the jacket of the book, I instantly had this kinship with you because you said Queens was this sort of place that you wanted everyone to see so they had a better understanding of America. And I mm-hmm. feel the same way about Detroit. Mm-hmm. So for you, what is it about Queens that makes you feel that way?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So here's the funny thing. I mean, I described to you a little bit about, like, you know, the crap apartment we lived in. And a funny anecdote about that, part of writing the memoir was revisiting certain places because, you know, memory is also emotion and vice versa. So stepping in and what do I remember? And I have to say, I go to my old building in Flushing. It's the end of the 7 train. If you've ever been, for example, to a tennis game in Queens, my stop was the one after that stop. Go to my old building, you know, it smells a little better, not much better. And I go to the mailroom, and you know, we were there in the 1980s, okay? Apartment 401, Shahani. It's like, you guys who run this place, you suck. Anyway. Here's what I love about where I grew up. I grew up in a working class United Nations, okay? Our neighbors were every nationality you could imagine. Some Eastern European, some second or third or fourth generation Italian or Irish American, lot of people from Asia, Africa, Latin America, spoke so many different languages. Because of where I grew up, I became incredibly comfortable with difference, even seeking it, needing it. And that's actually the American identity on hyperdrive. Okay. This country, this is the tricky thing, because it is our responsibility to critique what is wrong, to be aware of the racism, the tribalism, the nativism flaring up where it does, at the very top as well as the very bottom. We have to vigilantly watch out for that and know that it's not right. But there's a danger of missing the forest for the trees. Compared to most countries on Earth, the U.S. actually does pretty well when it comes to absorbing difference and diversity. What I mean by that, my parents really marveled at this. They were uprooted as children in the partition, as I'd mentioned to you, because Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims were literally roasting each other's babies on skewers, literally setting whole train cars on fire so they would come into a station with every body burned. I don't know the kinds of blood that my parents saw when they were little, because it was too much. My mom didn't have the memory. She was too young. For my father, there was a lot he couldn't talk about, which I get into in the book as well. But for those people, our people, to be at war in the ways that we were so brutally back home, and in Flushing, Queens, apartment 401 neighbors, sharing milk and sugar and food and babysitting each other's kids. That is powerful. It's incredibly powerful. The way that back home, you know, it's funny, even like look at interracial marriage, which happened, like that's every marriage in Flushing. You know, people fall in love with their neighbor, whatever, whatever. You know, back home, it's not like, oh, in India, it's okay to marry an Indian. They have to be your ethnic group. They have to be your caste. The question is, well, does their family eat garlic or not? Like, these are real questions that people ask before they'll let their child enter into another family. The U.S. is remarkable at fusion. And my hometown, and it sounds like yours as well, really encapsulates what makes this country unique, what is actually in the DNA of this country.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Aarti Shahani reads from her book, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Jerome Vaughn's conversation with Aarti Shahani.
So let's move ahead just a little bit. One of the things I think you started to get a better understanding of how the world works. Mm-hmm. The role of race in the world, the role of fairness in the world, mm-hmm. was when you got a scholarship to go to a high school in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that high school, and then I'll have a follow-up.
Okay. Yeah, so this high school, it's funny because I grew up in working-class United Nations Queens, where I saw every nationality. Fewer white people in my building, certainly, and in my public school. I got to Brearley, the Brearley School, and I had never seen so many white bodies apart from TV. I just hadn't seen it before. It blew my mind. And I remember, it's interesting because, you know, children's reactions, and adults as well, I just think that children are allowed to be more honest about it than adults are allowed to be. It's very visceral, you know, you sort of, this is where I also worry about, I think it needs to be safe for us to talk about the discomfort that we feel, because get real, we all feel it. That's different from saying it's okay to be a horrible human being to someone else. You know, it's a pretty bright line distinction. But I got there, and I was totally struck by the racial divide. I remember that they didn't really know what to make of me, because they were used to white kids and then a few black kids on scholarship. The Asian was a much less known quantity. And so I think in some ways that made me invisible or in the background to observe a lot of what was going on. And it's interesting because my school, the prep school, when I first got there, even though I was struck by the racial difference, what I really identified with was a building full of empowered girls. Because I grew up in a household where the expectation for me from my father, from my uncle, even from my big brother, from my cousins was, girls go in the kitchen and help their mothers make the meals. Men never set foot in that kitchen. So when you come home, even if you have homework to do, whatever, whatever, you make sure you get your actual duties done before you try this school thing. That was the message I got at home. At Brearley, I was like, I learned, oh, girls rule the world. It was amazing. I was like, ah, my people, not my people, but kind of my people. And what I will say, though, is that, and that's still very much how I feel about that place. Even like on book tour on the East Coast, each stop on the East Coast has had friends, and not even friends, like people from my high school class who I didn't even ever talk to because I didn't feel comfortable around, showing up to book tour and like, because they're interested women and they've been from a very young age. Now, all that said, I remember really wanting to think of my prep school as utopia because it wasn't my patriarchal home. And then as time passed, and I remember I have this scene in the book. It's junior year, and it's time to elect class presidents for the next year. And we do co-presidents, not just one, but a co-president system. And two black girls decided to run. These two black girls, star academically, star community service and community engagement, stars athletically, one incredibly extroverted and everyone's best friend, the other kind of introverted and nerdy. I thought they were like the perfect, one was a scholarship kid, kind of like me. The other was from a wealthier family. I was like, oh my God, they represent everything at Brearley, old and new, the haves and have nots, the, you know, very scholarly, the very charismatic. I was like, they're the perfect team. And wow, was there a white backlash. And I remember being a junior and being completely baffled by suddenly this sort of tribalism flare up. And a handful of white students deciding they were gonna run a team against the black students and the kind of things that I heard in the process. So it's just funny because I feel like so much of my childhood was searching for utopia and just not finding it and being overly disappointed at the fact it didn't exist.
So that experience, how did that change you?
Well, that experience was happening alongside the other experience of my life, which was that my father had been arrested, and my main extracurricular became watching him slowly decay, watching my mom vomit every day, and going to court for hearings. So I think that part of what I was seeing at my school was reflecting part of what I was seeing in the real world and at home.
Yeah, I was going to say, I felt like while these two paths were sort of parallel going on at the same time, mm-hmm. it did leave an indelible mark on you that some of your experiences later you could see. Let me ask you about your father at this point.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be hard for just about anybody in here to really have an understanding of what you went through, what your father went through when he was arrested, but that's a lot of what this book is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
You know, I can share a little bit, and then whenever it's the right moment, I'd love to read a scene that's very directly answering that question as well. So when my father was arrested, I mentioned to you he was taken to Rikers Island, as was my uncle. I grew up wanting to be a prosecutor because that was my sense of how you could achieve justice, put away the bad guys. I grew up with a lot of crime around me. And going to Rikers Island, that first visit, remains today the most important lesson I've had about the truth about America to this day, particularly the truth about the nightmare in America. We go to Rikers. And that sense of like, what are we doing here? I can't believe this is going on. Dad, what the hell have you gotten yourself into? And I had in my mind a lot of blame and anger towards him. What have you done, Dad? But when we got to that visitation room and I saw all the other people, it was kind of like a big gymnasium with metal chairs and tables set up. I got to that visitation room with my mom and my brother to visit Dad in his orange jumpsuit, and I look around me, and everybody in that enormous room was a person of color. And for all the rage I had toward him, I couldn't help but think, where are the white criminals?
We're still waiting for that answer.
And that's, you know, that's the thing. We call the book, it's Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Here We Are is a statement of fact. Whatever you want to try to do at the border, we are coming, we are here. This is the DNA of this country. The American Dreams, American Nightmares is basically my thesis about this country, which is that it is a duality, and the duality exists down to a single family. The life I have in this country, the magic doors, the secret doors that have opened for me that I never knew existed, like going to Brearley, being a scholarship kid there, that was just like my public school teacher being like, oh, you seem nerdy, try this thing out. And then wham, into a world of insane privilege, where my own climb from the humble origins that we have, it's leaps, it's just leaps and bounds from an early age. I have lived the dream. There's no doubt that I've lived the dream. I know that. And my father lived the nightmare. And I think that a lot of the nightmare in the U.S. is actually manufactured and created over and over again through the criminal system that touches a lot of lives. Too many lives, yeah.
Your experience with your father really changed your relationship with him, deepened your relationship with him. You had a visit to Rikers. Do you want to read that passage that really sort of says something about that?
Yeah. You know, I talked about Dad being brilliant, and I obviously have a lot of love and admiration for who he was. He's passed in 2015, but lives in me. And then there was, you know, he was also the guy who got on my nerves. You know, like, you might have had that dad. You might be that dad. You know? In our particular circumstances, he was the guy who worked 7 days a week, who came home, smoked Marlboros in the corner, didn't know him, didn't really ask questions. And when he talked to me, it was to say, that skirt is too short, that shirt is too tight. That was pretty much our conversation. I didn't like him. And then, as the legal case against him evolved and continued and morphed over the years, from that 8-month sentence to a surprise second punishment, which was a deportation proceeding that would last a decade, I turned toward Dad and I wanted to understand who he was. Not that that was my express goal, but it's what happened in the process of fighting like hell to keep my family in this country together. I talked a little bit about high school. I went to college at the University of Chicago. And when we learned that deportation was going to come after this sentence, and a lot had gone wrong in this case, I detail it in the book, there's just nothing worked the way it was supposed to. It's kind of like regular people make mistakes and we pay dearly. State prosecutors and legal authorities make mistakes and they pay nothing. It is what it is. Anyway, I was when it was time for Dad to serve his 8-month sentence, I was actually already in college by then. And I had this sense that this 8-month sentence was either going to be a life sentence or a death sentence. And the reason I say death sentence is my father's health had gone really south. He'd had a couple of heart attacks and he'd lost all of his teeth. You know, he was a guy in his late 50s who looked like he was in his late 70s. So I stopped going to college. Because either dad was going to die at Rikers Island, or right after he was done with the sentence, he was going to be automatically exiled, which was the life sentence. And I needed to be close to him. It wasn't like a spreadsheet decision. It was my body told me, Arthie, go home. You know, you've been doing everything in your power to get out of here. Go home. It's time. And I'm really happy I did that. And part of what happened in not going to school and being back home and fighting and learning about the legal system and that time off and whatnot, like, you know, it was a very productive time. I got to know my father. And so there's a passage I'll read to you from Here We Are that's about getting to know my father. It's about 5 minutes, okay? It took 3 hours to get to the last checkpoint, the open-air gym with the tiny tables. There was one woman standing in line in front of me, and she had enormous breasts. I could see a third of them heaving from her V-neck. Oh my goodness, I hope I recognize him, she turned back and told me. Huh? I didn't understand. My girlfriend set me up. I can't tell which one he is. You haven't met before? No, but he's going to be out soon. This woman was at Rikers Island on a first date. A blind first date. I wanted to shake her. Girl, I love a captive audience too, but this is taking it too far. Wait till he's out. Good luck, were the words I managed to mouth. A corrections officer pointed to the tiny table where she'd meet her man, no guesswork required, and then pointed me to Dad. You look tired, my doll, he said as we sat down. No, I'm good. Are you eating enough? Yeah, Dad, I'm eating plenty. That question got on my nerves. Mom, who was still vomiting multiple times a day, would ask it to me. And, sensing my irritation, she'd latch on, persisting either as martyr mom, Arthie, I ask because I'm your mother, or as infomercial mom, I have homeopathic pills, try them. Dad had the sense to back off. I gave him the London debrief, ending with how Ange, my big sister, went missing. He laughed a deep laugh. That daughter of his could brighten any day. She was so different from him and me that way, a constant reminder of how good it could be if you just let loose sometimes. A few tables over, an inmate sprung from a steel chair and threw it against the wall. Guards raced over and pinned his face and shoulders down. I thought they were about to call off visitation for everyone. They didn't. They just dragged him away. You're not where you thought you'd be, huh? I said to Dad. He shook his head. No, not at all, he said without saying. The silence lingered for a moment. Conversation didn't come naturally. Inside jail, outside, it always took effort with us. How'd you learn Arabic? I decided to try the interview approach. Did you have books? Tapes? No, I learned by attending the customers, he said. Each day I listened for the important words. Slowly, slowly, I picked up very good Arabic. Important words like what? Kaif halikum, barak alafik, arak lahikan, ana ahabuk habibti. How are you? God bless you. See you. You are my love. That last one stood out. Who taught you that? I asked. There's no way Dad's boss taught it to him. It's a funny thing. You make me go back so many years. He smiled and hesitated for a moment. It was an Armenian girl. She asked me for a date. She said in Arabic as well as in Armenian, Ana Abuka, I love you. Did you say it back to her? I was nervous. I was shocked. I never had a girlfriend. I never went out with anybody. It was strange for me to hear someone say that. But we did go to see a movie. It was in the heat of the night. That was the Sidney Poitier film, where an African-American detective goes to the Deep South and gets wrongfully arrested for the murder of a white businessman. Dad was a 25-year-old migrant worker out with an Armenian flight attendant watching a movie about American race relations. My first date was Boys in the Hood. I was in seventh grade. Out with a Chinese-American boy who won my heart because he could name every highway that crossed through Queens. Neither Dad nor I were allowed to date. I didn't mention these parallels. He continued, in the theater, I came to know she spoke English too. I didn't know that before. We came out of the theater. We spoke English, French, Arabic. It was nice. I began to imagine what she'd looked like in the dark. If Dad turned to see her profile or just stared straight ahead the whole time. If their fingers or forearms brushed as they strolled the beach after the movie. If they listened to the waves lap, or if she found conversation with him more easily than I did. They met when she came to the tourist trap where he worked. She bought leather sandals and brass vases, little trinkets for family and friends. She came back again and again. Then one day she asked if he had time for coffee. At the time, I didn't have permission. The bosses were strict. On some Sundays, I was allowed to leave. So we went for coffee a few times, but the cinema was just once. Why not more? I asked him. You love movies. Because I couldn't afford it. She was spending money all the time. I didn't like that. I had limited pocket expenses. I had to think of my family first. When I went back to India, she wrote me a letter. She said, I'm waiting for you. And she sent me a photo. She told me, show to your family. Did you? I asked. Yes, I showed them. My mother, brothers, sisters. They said, who's that girl? Are you taking up the foreign way? Having a girlfriend? Dad shrugged. I didn't much bother about it because I knew I wouldn't be able to and also take care of my family. I see, I began to paraphrase. Because you knew if you were going to pursue a relationship, you couldn't send as much money back home, so you either could have a girlfriend or be a good son. Yes, that's true. I felt sorry for young Dad and this Armenian romantic who thought love could transcend distance. Dad hadn't answered my question, which I repeated. Okay, so then did you ever tell her, I love you back? No, I didn't say anything, he laughed at himself. I was nervous and just smiling and putting my head down like a little girl. I'm sorry to say, but a fact is a fact. Time's up, a guard called out to us. Time never flies with Dad. This was a first. As I boarded the white bus that went to the visitor center, the woman who'd had her blind date slipped into the bench beside me. How'd it go? I felt obligated to ask her. Really well, she smiled ear to ear. We're going to see each other again. That's great, I feigned approval. Yes, I was judging her, though the uncanny resemblance was not lost on me. She was at Rikers, getting to know a stranger. So was I.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of WDET News Director Jerome Vaughn's conversation with journalist and author Aarti Shahani.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to WDET's Jerome Vaughn talking with Aarti Shahani.
One of the things that jumps out at me about that passage, and actually runs throughout the book in a number of ways, is the way that your father felt this duty to his family, and as he got married and had you kids, continued to fill that duty, you sort of picked up that duty to your father. As he was in prison, you became almost a lawyer of sorts, working on things. And you also found out some very interesting and even discouraging things about the legal system during that time. Tell us a little bit about that effort to start to be a de facto lawyer.
Yeah, I actually ended up designing and teaching a curriculum that lawyers got credit for from the Bar Association, too. It was kind of a very wild journey. What happened is that I told you I'd stopped going to college for a while. During that time, I was visiting Dad. I was working to make money, and I was just writing and hustling to everybody who could be able to help us to find help for my father. Because I knew that pretty much deportation was going to be automatic, and it would take some kind of insane miracle to stop it. So I'm like, I'm on the hunt for an insane miracle. I ended up, through an email I sent to, we had a 5-foot television at home, because this was part of our American dream, was like the 5-foot TV. And we hadn't had to sell it yet, it was still at home, and I had seen this immigration lawyer talking about H-1B visas and marital petitions, and I emailed him, and I'm like, hi, my family has green cards or we're U.S. citizens. My dad is going to be delegalized because of laws passed in 1996 under President Clinton. That lawyer invited me to come and speak at the New York City Bar Association. And I just kind of thought, New York City Bar, oh, that's just like hundreds of lawyers. I'll go there and they'll fix everything for me. That'll be great. And what actually happened, Jerome, is that I went to the city bar. And this is all before September 11th. Hundreds of people in a packed room. And on the panel, the same panel where I was going to eventually speak, was a congressman, Barney Frank. This guy, Beau Cooper, the top prosecutor for the entire immigration agency. A lawyer from NYU, like just very high-powered people. Like one of the people on that panel would decide my father's fate. Regular people don't get to sit that close to power typically. It doesn't happen. It was a first for me. And in that room where I eventually also for the first time shared my father's story, the legal issues, basically just crying out to the room, can any of you help me? I came to learn that my family was at the forefront of a national crisis, which was that Bill Clinton had signed these laws, these two laws, one of them on the anniversary of Timothy McVeigh bombing the Oklahoma City Federal Building. So there was like a vehement anti-immigrant measure on the anniversary of, you know, mass violence perpetrated by a white man. But what I came to learn in that room was, oh, Clinton signed these laws, get tough on immigrants like we get tough on crime, like we get tough on welfare moms. That was the ethos of the 90s. And suddenly all these lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, are hearing from their constituents because families, including long-term legal permanent residents, are like, holy crap, we're about to be exiled. So what ended up happening is the room I stepped into to find a lawyer for my dad, and I didn't end up finding one in that room, also opened my eyes to the political reality, which was that mass incarceration is a term we now know, and thankfully it's a term that more and more people are critical of. The ethos today is different from the 90s. We're not where we need to be yet, but it is different from the 90s. Mass deportation is a subsequent related phenomenon. And that's what we were discovering, and that's what we were undergoing. And millions of people since then have been touched by it. But that room catapulted me into an entire career of accidental activism. So, you know, I joke I'm IT lady on NPR, right? That's how I've spent my 30s. I spent my 20s in prisons and jails working with immigrants who were prisoners who were going to be deported and their families. That was all of my 20s. I basically wore sweatpants and a sweatshirt and a ponytail and ran around with a bullhorn. I didn't have a nice microphone. I literally had like a bullhorn and organized ad hoc rallies in front of like the federal building. I stayed in activism until I was about 30, burned out horrifically. This book, you know, it's First and foremost, it's a eulogy for my father, because he's one of those people who didn't get to matter. It's a lot of people, and he should have. He didn't die with dignity, and he should have. It's absolutely a love letter to the families I relate to, who I see in my newsfeed now. They are not to me alien invaders. They are not to me whatever the headlines and the politicians call them. They are me and I am them. And I also hope that this book can really touch the young people, because there's this beautiful youth movement sweeping not just this country but the world. You know, you see the brightness and the intelligence and the passion and the commitment. And I actually wrote specific chapters in this book where I just lay my soul out about burnout and over-identification and hating myself. Because it can be tricky. It can be very tricky when you fight for a cause to over-identify with it.
How difficult is it to be as honest as you are in this book? In a number of places, you reveal thoughts that you had but did not voice. In a number of places, as you were saying, you look back and you talk about yourself very critically. Mm. How hard was it for you to be that honest about yourself?
That part did not feel hard. To me, it was remarkably easier than the script I was reading as when I was fighting to keep my father here. I mean, this is the big difference between me now versus me in my 20s. In my 20s, I was desperately trying to keep my family together. So I didn't have the luxury of going into congressional office. I was mounting a political campaign. We weren't going to win through the courts. We were going to win through a political campaign. I didn't have the luxury of being honest. Because when you're fighting a campaign, you've got to do talking points. You've got to push. You've got to stay on message. I get it. I see people do it. As a journalist, it annoys me when I interview people. I can hear the talking points. I also get it. I respect it. I know where it's coming from. Well, you know what? My family isn't under threat of deportation anymore. I'm now a woman of privilege. And so I would say that I finally got to tell the honest version, and I'd wanted to.
Let's talk about victory. Hmm. What was victory like?
When the legal matter was finally settled, and I guess for the sake of readers, spoiler alert? I'm so confused about how to do this. I'll say it at a high level. Yeah, I can do this without...
No, I was going to say, so you didn't win. We'll just say that. There was no victory. How's that?
No, I actually think that that's what I'm questioning in the book. I think that this book was a process of me figuring out, did we actually win or not? Was it actually worth it or not? I needed to figure that out. But what I will say is that there is a moment that is certainly a type of victory. I think that we're talking about the same one. And I remember that moment. I suddenly felt... It's not literally how I felt, but it's emotionally how I felt. Like I'd had this open wound and like an invisible hand stopped picking the scab at me. And I was like, wow, I've been on a decade-long anxiety attack. And now that I didn't have to deal with the threat that was always there because it had been resolved, I was like, what do I do with myself now? I literally just felt like I could breathe again. I felt like I could breathe. And I had no idea how much weight I was carrying until it was lifted. And that's a very common feeling. I mean, like when you're going through trauma, when you're going through pain, if it lasts long enough, you forget what normal feels like. And then once you have normal back, you don't even know what to do with it. And that was me up until I was 30. Once I was in my 30s and living my fancy life. Actually, wasn't true. But what really happened is I hit 30 and, you know, I was tired of being an immigrant daughter and I had crap credit. Like my credit score was so bad. I was terrified. And I just wanted to rebuild it. I wanted to live a practical life, not a passionate life. I'm like, passion is overrated. Give me something practical and steady, please. And I raced into journalism because relative to everything I had been doing, it just felt like an incredibly safe place. And it's a funny thing to say because a lot of people go into journalism for passion, but for me it was a kind of different entry point, business journalism specifically. Anyway, because I'm on NPR, all sorts of people who would never have given me the time of day before suddenly give me the time of day. On LinkedIn, I get a message from the guy who ran Rikers Island. He's like, oh, Rikers Island, the Joe where my father was. We have mutual friends. He's like, next time you're in New York, let's grab some coffee. He's a brilliant, multidimensional, interesting man. He's not actually what you would expect as the top jailer of the most notorious jail in the country. We get together, quaint little cafe on the Upper East Side. From the conversation and previous conversations we've had, he knows I'm interested in criminal justice even though I report on tech, and he's wondering why. My dad was a prisoner at Rikers. Oh, that's interesting, didn't know that. He asked me about the case, the judge's name. Tell him, Joel Blumenfeld. Oh, is that right? He's my very best friend. We go back to the Vietnam War days. You want to meet him? And I read this, he's like, he made it sound like a Tinder date. And I was like, what? swipe. So I didn't know why I said yes, but I said yes. And this is when I was just getting my foothold in NPR. I had just been hired as an actual employee for my beat, and I was feeling my security and whatnot. It's just starting to happen. Anyway, the judge, via email, invites me to come visit him in his private chambers in Queens. Wow, I have no idea why, but sure, I'll go meet this guy. I go during a business trip. Walk into Queens Courthouse. I'm having these sort of flashbacks, like memory is physical, these flashbacks to certain things. Anyway, I go to his chambers. First words out of his mouth. Before I sit down, before anything, first words out of his mouth. Young lady, your father and uncle should never have taken that guilty plea. What a mistake. And I remember feeling like my spirit had left my body. I wanted to collapse. I went over to SoFi, sat down. He talked. I vaguely remember what we talked about. Now, I'm a journalist. It's my job to ask questions and gather information. If I were there on assignment, I would have been like, fascinating, tell me more. As a daughter. And so we weren't talking about some random case. We were talking about my father and our livelihood. And that judge had no clue what happened to us after he hit that gavel. He had no clue. So it was horrifically painful to sit there. As soon as I could find my way out of those chambers, I got out, and then the tears flooded. Just like ugly crying, like really ugly crying. Weeping all the way home. Never told my father. Never told my father about that conversation. Couldn't bring myself to, because I didn't want him to hurt the way that I hurt. But that was, Jerome, a lesson also in trauma, because it took me a while, and it was iterative, for me to realize how much that chapter actually hurt and defined me, in certain ways broke me. It took me a while. And knowing, like, that judge's visit, that happened, and it took me, I think it was 3 years before I had the wherewithal, the stamina, the desire to go back to him and actually do a sit-down interview to dissect what he really meant, which is also in the book.
Throughout the book, your dad calls you Dal.
Yeah, Dal.
And
Dal.
And he says ha before. I want you to say it the way he says it.
Ha, my Dal. Well,
What does that phrase mean to you? Here, what does it mean here?
We write eulogies to resurrect people when they're gone. So it's funny because when writing about, like, I didn't expect that I was going to try to capture so much of his voice in the writing. Like, I didn't know that the story would have so much dialogue and that these little things about, he called me Dal, my Dal, also my Pichkari, which means the little one, the baby, in one of the languages he spoke, Sindhi, our ethnic language. mom and dad, they called each other darling, which is darling, but with their accent. And it was funny because they would, you know, sometimes every once in a while it would be a sweet, my darling, but usually it was darling. And it just, I guess, you know, it, like I'm getting emotional now, it made me emotional. It's like I have never cried so much as I've cried writing this book. I can't recall being 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever little age. I can never recall crying as much as in this process. And thankfully, I don't mind it. I'm not afraid of my emotions. You know, and I think it's really good. This is how, to me, it's kind of like when you sweat when you exercise, you cry when you write, or sometimes. But it's a way to metabolize what's inside. Yeah. But, you know, it's just, I needed to resurrect them.
Now you're gonna make me cry.
I just told you it's okay, you can.
I guess just really the last question. After reading this book and getting to know your family so well, I feel like we could hang out with them through this book. I still can't figure out whether you are, after all these experiences, an optimist or a pessimist? Which is it?
I'm a curmudgeonly, kind of contrarian optimist.
All right, we'll take that. We'll take that. So we'll take this moment to say, please go and get a copy of Arthi's book. Get 3 or 4 for your friends and family. They make great Christmas gifts,
They make great Christmas gifts.
And please, a warm round of applause for Arthi Shahani.
Oh, thank you.
That was Arthi Shahani talking with Jerome Vaughn. Arthi Shahani's book is Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.